This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Schatz, wir müssen los zu meiner Mutter.
Oh, ich kann leider nicht mit. Der Mähroboter mäht immer noch nicht, wo er soll.
Immer findest du eine Ausrede.
Ja, nein, das ist nicht so leicht.
Sonst läuft bei dir doch auch alles automatisch.
Weniger Ausreden, mehr Automatisierung. Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Stimme deinen Husqvarna-Mähroboter durch individuelle Installation exakt auf deine Anforderungen ab. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On today's Nolan Show, it's Linda McCauley's last interview while she's here on BBC Radio Ulster. She's the big part of the show today. She's on the podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. Groups campaigning against a plan to construct massive gas storage caverns in Larne Loch have won their latest legal bid. The proposal was to use water to hollow out seven storage caverns, each the size of an average skyscraper, under the water in Larne Loch. The space would then be used to store natural gas. The company behind the scheme said the facility would provide the island of Ireland and the wider UK with security of energy supply. But the Court of Appeal has said the proposal was cross-cutting in nature, and they ruled the former Minister, Edwin Poots, acted irrationally in not referring the project to the Executive for full consideration. Lisa Dobby is from the No Gas Caverns Group. Morning to you, Lisa.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the former DUP Special Advisor, David Graham, with us today. Morning to you, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, David, for those people that think that, look, this might sound dry, this is about energy, and energy affects everything we do in Northern Ireland. What's going on here?
Well, I think, Stephen, people probably didn't understand the significance of three letters when you put them together, R-E-H-I, around a decade ago or less than a decade ago. And we all know the impact that an energy scheme had on the stability of Northern Ireland, in fact. I think in this issue, there's no doubt that it's certainly one that is sparking those with strong views on the environment. But I also think, Stephen, there's a secondary issue, and it's that obviously we have a situation where we put government ministers in charge of departments based upon the allocation from the Hunt. But we can now see that there is a mechanism to block government ministers making decisions because of the system of government that we now are under. And I think that brings about a wider issue. And that issue is no one wants to make difficult decisions in Northern Ireland because A, they're not popular, Stephen. B, they're potentially to be blocked. And therefore, what's the result? Inefficient government. And we now have a situation where good people like yourself are having to bring this to the public.
Spell out the basics of this to people, David.
Well, the basics of this, as far as I can see, Stephen, is that Edwin Poots has made a decision which has then been taken to court by Friends of the Earth and other environmental lobby groups. Now, having looked into this, I actually have a lot of sympathy for the position of these groups because I think actually the damage potentially to the sea, the damage to wildlife, the damage to other species is significant. But I also, I think, to remain balanced, have also got sympathy for those who will say, well, actually, every time we turn on the news, we're told about a cost of living crisis, we're told about serious economic issues and how we go about revenue raising. And we may have an energy source here, which would assist in, as you said, heating and lighting people's homes in Northern Ireland. And we may be turning our nose up at it and turning our back on it. So this is actually a very big issue, which I think there's a danger that it'll be lost in amongst the excitement of an election in a few weeks.
So these would be huge. They would be massive gas storage facilities, wouldn't they? And there would be seven of them. They'd be 80 metres in diameter, 185 metres in height, proposed at Island McGee. And the Court of Appeal is, if you look at Newton Emerson, he'll be joining us later. He was writing in the Irish News that the Court of Appeal mystified, is how he described it, as to why other executive parties, the Irish Times, sorry, as to why other executive parties publicly objected to Larn Gas Cavern Project, yet didn't act in the executive to block it. Lisa Dobie, set out your position here on this.
Well, just regarding your final point there, I mean, yes, there was criticisms of ministers for not asking for the project to be taken to the executive table. But, I mean, it's not really for me to speak for ministers, but it could be that they believe that they're not over-briefed in the same way as the actual minister who's due to take a decision.
But why are you objecting to this? Let's get into it.
Well, okay. We are objecting to this. Initially, it came to our attention due to the dispersal of the hypersaline brine. I mean, it isn't salty water going into the sea. I mean, this is poisonous, destructive, polluting hypersaline brine that will be pumped into the sea because they need to solution mine the salt layers under Larnlough to create these caverns. So that you know, initially sort of came to our attention with the kilometres wide spread of hypersaline brine at the seabed, according to the company's own reports. Excuse me. So obviously we're fearful for wildlife. With the immediacy of the discharge pipe, any creature that couldn't move away would die. And this brine is also being pumped into sort of designated areas of scientific and...
Well, the company behind this scheme are saying this will provide the island of Ireland, Lisa, and the wider UK with security of energy supply. Are you weighing that up?
We did, and to be honest, it's actually true. There's only one-way flow of gas pipes into Northern Ireland. So at the moment, gas comes in to Northern Ireland via the Scotland-Northern Ireland pipeline. That only flows one way, so all our gas comes from GB. And the same into Ireland, the gas flows one way into Ireland. There would have to be other work done to reverse flow pipes to move gas back to the mainland GP and also to Ireland. And I will point out at this point that actually Department for the Economy said this gas storage was not a necessity. So, you know, I'd be sort of tempted to bow to their greater knowledge. I mean, that was their consultation response at the time, which sort of backed our view that this gas was not required. Department for the Economy said that they were content that there was enough supply into Northern Ireland.
I mentioned Newton Emerson earlier.
Yes.
Newton, how much of an opportunity missed so far is this for Northern Ireland?
For the gas caverns?
Yes.
Well, there was a £400 million investment talked about 15 years ago. So you can add 15 years of inflation onto that. There's also reports that it's between 2 and 6 weeks supply for the whole gas supply for the whole island of Ireland. And that evens out supply, reduces prices because of the way gas is bought. And then you need to consider the difference that it would have made during the energy crisis after the invasion of Ukraine. I think it's realistic to suggest that we could all have saved hundreds of pounds a year.
But the gas caverns wouldn't even have been operational at that point.
No, the gas caverns the gas caverns were originally due to be operational under the original plan in 2022.
I know that the company itself went into abeyance. I mean, that they sort of the project stalled in sort of 2014, 2015.
Whether it did stall or not, Lisa, you're against it ever happening.
From the obviously natural environment, as David explained earlier, you know, definitely very nasty impacts on the natural environment. We are now in a climate emergency, and there now is policy against fossil fuels. The Department for the Economy said that the caverns are not a necessity. So, you know, if the Department for the Economy gas department is saying that these caverns
Can I come in here? Well, firstly, the gas caverns campaign lost its High Court judicial review on all its environmental claims and didn't appeal any of them, and it appealed on other grounds. And I think that expert reports understandably confirmed you can't pollute the sea with salt water. You're talking here to carve this out, a one-off discharge of salt water. So that's not happening. And the urgency of the project was underscored when the EU declared it a strategic priority in 2013 and offered funding for the whole of Europe. This would be the only facility of its kind on the island of Ireland, the only place to build it. And even in 2014, 2013, when they declared that, with Russia already attacking Ukraine and turning the gas off to Ukraine, it was painfully obvious that we were going to need a strategic asset like that. And the EU priority that they gave, and they renewed it again in 2017, means that member states, and that would conclude us in this instance, need to progress that as a priority.
Okay, can I come back to you then, Newton? I mean, you're talking about the PCI list, which is a project of common interest. This project was dropped by the PCI list before we actually left the European Union due to, in their opinion, the benefits did not outweigh the costs. So this project ceased to be a project of common interest
It wasn't dropped. You have to reapply for PCI status and the application wasn't able to go in. For various reasons, including obviously the need for strategic gas storage has only increased since 2013. That's a misrepresentation.
And Eilean Magee Energy were asked if discharge would begin into the lock, and they said no. The brine will be discharged into the Irish Sea at an approved distance offshore, where it will be dispersed by the tidal streams. Excuse me,
Stephen. Can I just interject for one second? Sorry, excuse me. I think. It's actually baffling that we've got the like of Newton, who is clearly across the detail here, more so it feels than members of the executive. And this is what actually concerns me about how we govern Northern Ireland. How is it and why is it that the Nolan Show seems to actually have more detail from contributors and from the like of yourself as well, Stephen, than we actually know from government ministers? Because this has ended up in court at the cost of the public purse. And we're now having discussed it in the Friday morning, because it feels to me that even though you see manifestos of parties, particularly the likes of the Alliance Party, you're clearly trying to eat into the Green Party's vote, didn't seem to make any mention of this, and it seemed to have to end up in court rather than being discussed.
Well, you're having a pop at the Alliance Party, because that's what you want to do. They're not here to defend themselves this morning,
I'm not having
and
a
you're,
pop.
You're
I'm
a former a DUP special advisor. What have the DUP done about this?
Stephen, 100%, I'm not having a pop at just the Alliance Party. I'm having a pop at all executive parties, because I don't understand how you can write pages upon pages of a manifesto, but then you can get yourself to a situation where it's now being discussed on the radio, because it seems to almost have just sailed through and passed the executive table without so much as a murmur or a grunt.
Can we be fair to two of the executive parties here? Now, the SDLP approved this in 2013. They gave it its initial licence. That was Alex Atwood, and then Edwin Poots gave it its marine license in 2021. So those two parties have stood over this project. In the appeal court ruling this week, the judge was confused as to why the Greens and Sinn Féin and the UUP, one UUP MLA, and Alliance had objected to this project in public, but had not raised it in the executive. So there was an accusation, an implication from the court there, that some political parties, some are objecting to the project in public for grandstanding reasons, while quietly nodding it through in the executive to keep the lights on. And the problem with this ruling, which only focuses on that process, is that that judge has said, if anyone objects to something in public, now they must raise that in the executive and go through the entire consensus process, you know, the veto, the St Andrews veto. So we've now, unfortunately, if this ruling stands, got to a situation where our politicians aren't free to object to something in public, but wave it through behind closed doors. Cynical as you might call that, that's what little chance there is at Stormont of getting anything done. Now, if anyone complains about anything, everyone has to agree with it at the executive.
Well, it's not just a complaint, is it? No.
The judge mentioned one UUP MLA complaining, not the UUP, one UUP MLA. So now, according to this ruling, if any one executive party's member complains about something, every executive party has to agree to it behind closed doors.
Well,
if this ruling stands, nothing will ever get done here again.
Newton, Lady Justice Keegan said the ministerial decision that the project was not deemed significant or controversial was irrational.
Yes, but the High Court judge last year said that that's just normal politics. So we have two differences of opinion here. And, you know, obviously the judge, the appeal court judge, is being extremely principled and rational, but I think has made no allowance for the normal operation of politics and the discretion that we need to allow our parties to show. Otherwise, they're never going to be able to reach a decision on anything.
Can you spell out... Yes, Lisa, go ahead.
Sorry, Stuart, if I could just jump in here again. We are assuming we know what's in ministers' minds here as well. Firstly, with the other ministers around the executive table, as I said before, they might believe that a minister is more over a brief than they would be. They maybe also believe that a ministerial colleague would act rationally and in accordance with the ministerial code. So surely ministers should be able to sit back and a colleague to, you know, act within the ministerial code.
No, I don't think so. If you're talking about every minister at the executive wondering, is this cross-cutting? Is this part of my remit? Is this part of my department? Mm-hmm. Is it controversial? Is it significant? And if not one of them thinks it is, then it isn't by definition. And that was what Belfast High Court found in 2023. Now, the appeal judge has said effectively, you can't do that if it's hypocritical. Well, that's the end of politics, really, and political decision making. This ruling can't stand.
Hold on a minute, Lisa. If we make this, Newton, accessible to the people on the ground who are caring about their bills, the court process and the political implications of this absolutely are important. But for those people caring about energy bills, how does this affect them?
Well, the way gas is bought and shipped around means that if you don't have any storage facility at all, and we're very, very short of it in the UK, then prices spike up and down. And you'll know that from your own gas bill. The more storage there is, the smoother your bill, and ultimately the lower it is on average. That's the difference it makes.
Sorry, go ahead, Lisa.
Sorry, Stephen. I mean, rough storage, I think, is reopening just to store some more gas, because I know they closed a few years ago, it was a criticism of government at the time. But again, I come back to Department for the Economy. They have said that this storage is not a necessity, that we have a plentiful supply of gas coming in to Northern Ireland. And again, any gas that's in Northern Ireland is stuck in Northern Ireland. It would have come from GB. At the moment, there is no route for that gas to go back to GB and no route for that gas to reach Ireland.
There were plans to build a cross-border pipeline. Also, the gas pipe that comes into us from Scotland also branches off in the sea and goes to the Republic. All gas on the island of Ireland is coming down that one route.
Okay.
And the whole plan for the gas caverns was to be able to sell this into the Republic as well. And in fact, Gaelectric in the Republic was a major investor in it. So that's not the case.
Okay, Newton and Lisa, thank you very much indeed. We'll leave it there. Morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. Less than 2 weeks to go until the general election. Last night, Fiona Bruce presented a 2-hour leader special for the larger parties on the BBC, with members of the panel facing questions from the audience. Rishi Sunak, Sir Keir Starmer, Sir Ed Davey, John Swinney each faced 30 minutes of questions from an audience of voters in York. How did they do? Well, Professor of Politics at Liverpool University, John Tong, with us today. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Let's look, first of all, at how the Prime Minister was quizzed about allegations of illegal betting by the angry audience member at this BBC Question Time special.
Aren't these emerging allegations about betting on the election date the absolute epitome of the lack of ethics that we have had to tolerate from the Conservative Party for years and years?
And Rishi Sunak said he was angered by what had emerged.
Well, like you, I was incredibly angry to learn of these allegations. It's a really serious matter. It's right that they're being investigated properly by the relevant law enforcement authorities, including, as Fiona said, a criminal investigation by the police. You know, I want to be crystal clear that if anyone has broken the rules, they should face the full force of the law.
How did he do last night, John?
Pretty well, Rishi Sunak, in difficult circumstances, because obviously there is a sense of outrage over these bets. There wasn't much he could say legally. He could have said a little more about the the two-party aides, but he couldn't say much where there's actually a police investigation going on. There's two separate investigations going on. One is the Gambling Commission's, and the other is a police one. And by talking about one, you could potentially prejudice the other. So I understand why Rishi Sunak played that with a very straight bat. But obviously, you know, there is a sense of outrage that people seem to be... the allegation is that people might have been on the make here, even on the in terms of the date of the election. So it put Rishi Sunak on the defensive straight away. I felt that he did deal with it, though, as competently as he could under the circumstances, while still, you know, not being able to get rid of the overall image that there is sleaze and people potentially on the make within his own party. I mean, the most robust line he offered was that he did promise that he would expel anyone found guilty of placing bets from the Conservative Party.
If you look at that national debate last night, John, Rishi Sunak, as representing the government, obviously, he's the Prime Minister, he was hit hard about hospital waiting lists. He was challenged time after time about them. And that's where it was very, very tough. He had to admit that was his biggest failing, that he hadn't got them down more. You look at the campaign here in Northern Ireland, and hospital waiting lists, are they actually being pinned on any particular political party? Is the Stormont executive being held to account during this election campaign? And I just notice how powerful the audiences are across the water about those waiting lists. Do you?
Yeah, exactly. Waiting lists are far, far worse in Northern Ireland than they are on my side of the Irish Sea. I agree in terms of last night, it was definitely Rishi Sunak's worst moment, because the basic line, the whole theme of the programme was about trust. And Rishi Sunak had made certain pledges as to what he would do when he became Prime Minister. He clearly failed. He didn't try and disguise the figures. He had to admit that in terms of getting hospital waiting lists down, he had failed. He made the point, but it sounded rather lame, that in the last couple of months they've begun to come down, but nowhere near to the point where, you know, Rishi Sunak had originally promised. He did make the point as well, look, we're putting more and more money into the NHS. And it's true, that is true, statistically true, even allowing for inflation. Successive Conservative governments have put more money into the NHS. But you've got to, firstly, because we've got an ageing population, and secondly, because treatments are improving. So in one sense, the NHS is a victim of their own success. As you keep people living longer, then, you know, they require more and more health treatment. I mean,
the NHS not more of an election issue here in Northern Ireland? Should it be?
Because all the parties in Northern Ireland say, look, we need a new fiscal framework for Northern Ireland. We need new financial arrangements which will address the chronic state of the NHS in Northern Ireland. So all the parties can bat it off and blame it all on Westminster and the funding model, in the same way that, you know, it's a line that regularly comes from the SNP. They'll refer to Tory austerity. Now, there's some truth in that. There never is enough money for the NHS. There certainly isn't enough money for Northern Ireland. There is some sort of broad political consensus, at least emerging, that Northern Ireland needs more money. But the line from the Conservative government in recent years has been, okay, you might have a case for more money, but let's see the colour of your money that's raised locally. And that's where we get into difficulty, because obviously, you know, the prescription charges, if I'm not feeling well, I have to go and pay nearly £10 in prescription charges for each medicine that I need. That's not the case in Northern Ireland. That's not singling Northern Ireland out. You don't pay prescription charges in Scotland or Wales either. So it's a question of whether people will be prepared to put more money in themselves in Northern Ireland or not. You can understand why you wouldn't want to be paying prescription charges. If you've got a regular complaint, that can cost you an awful lot of money if you're of working age and you're having to pay regularly for medicine. So I do understand it.
Is the NHS so broken here in Northern Ireland that no political party can actually come up with anything radical to fix it? Is it broken no matter what?
It's not entirely broken, but I mean, in terms of waiting lists, you could argue it's certainly broken. The length of waiting lists is absolutely chronic. If one line of treatment, ear, nose and throat surgery, some people have been on waiting lists for almost 2 years. I mean, those waiting lists, frankly, wouldn't be tolerated anywhere else in the UK. They've become absolutely abysmal. And the point is, as well, it preceded COVID. The NHS crisis in Northern Ireland preceded COVID, but nothing's been done about it, really. I mean, the Bengoa report, in terms of restructuring aspects of the NHS, lies gathering dust, never fully implemented. Fiscal arrangements for Northern Ireland have not been changed. And the idea that a Labour government is simply, you know, if we have one come July the 5th, that it's simply going to plough loads of money into Northern Ireland to alleviate it. I think it's for the birds.
Well, we can bring Andrew McCormick in on that. Andrew is a former leading civil servant. He's been around all the corners of Northern Ireland's public services for many, many years. Former permanent secretary at Department of Finance, Personnel, Department of Health, Social Services, Public Safety. Morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So, John wondering what the implications will be if Labour and Sir Keir Starmer come to power.
So they've made it very, very clear they're going to remain very cautious that the campaign, their stance, because they feel so vulnerable to the charge of increasing taxes, that's a massive political play in the election campaign. My thought is that in time, there'll be a big difference. There's a big difference of what drives parties politically. The Conservatives will always prioritise tax cuts. If the same money was available to Labour, they're much more likely to use it for public services. So John's right that there's no chance of an immediate big solution. But over time, my view is that a Labour Party approach to funding of public services will be more generous. Now, that's the kind of big political judgment that is made. It's determined by the electorate in England, where John is, and we get the consequences of that choice.
Who would be more likely to be more generous or open to the argument, open to persuasion that Northern Ireland is such a special case that we need treated completely differently, Andrew?
Special case arguments have been tried and failed. I was involved in negotiations on special cases in the 1980s, the 1990s, and during the first executive between 1999 and 2002. The Treasury is very tired of those arguments. And if we as a region want to stand on our own feet and project as a stable working place, then just holding out the hand for more is not the way forward. Yes, there's a case. Yes, there are issues of need, but those can be dealt with in a rational and reasonable way.
Are they being dealt with in a rational way at the moment?
So a big improvement. I think the decision earlier this year to take account of need in fixing the Northern Ireland budget is very, very significant. That followed on from what happened with Wales more than 10 years ago, where they'd established a floor, what's called the Holtham floor, the Barnett floor, the fiscal floor, so that whenever the allocations are made, they don't fall below the basic level of need. That's a big advance, but it does depend on what the UK government decides at the general level. That's what really determines whether the results are manageable or not.
Do you think we're heading towards a fiscal cliff edge here in Northern Ireland?
Well, that came about because of the arithmetic of the settlement reached back in February. But since then, the finance minister announced not that long ago that there were positive negotiations, recognition by the Treasury.
Yeah, but nothing written down. And obviously, right? Nothing written down. And obviously, if there's a new government, all bets are off. Well, are they not?
Yes, no parliament can bind its successor. That's absolutely true. I think that there's far more likelihood of a Labour government actually taking account of the needs in that sense and avoiding a cliff edge if they hold to the principle of not falling below the relative need that has been established. So there's a very positive chance of that. And the thing is that still leaves enormous issues. So the point, part of the really important point here is that neither the Conservatives nor Labour are being honest with the electorate about the implications of the current fiscal position for the years ahead. I heard someone from the Institute for Fiscal Studies talking about a conspiracy of silence in the last few days. They both know that taxes are rising. They both know that to maintain the fiscal rules, expenditure has to not just stay steady, but be reduced. And they both need to find solutions to that. Everyone's talking about growth as a solution. And, well, yes, everyone should be for growth. But you can't make it happen just by government decree. And therefore, Labour will be faced with a very serious dilemma. And that's why, actually, coming back to health, we really need to look at what we do about the health service, both in Northern Ireland and across the UK.
How have you been thinking when you've heard lots of revenue-raising measures here in Northern Ireland being immediately ruled out, Andrew?
Well, it's understandable. It's politics. Look at every time a Conservative spokesman opens their mouth, they say Labour will put up taxes. It's very electorally popular, and that's been part of the sell by many of the parties locally as well, to keep revenue down, keep rates down. That's seen as a success story.
Mike, they have to, after the election, go back
well,
on that.
Yes. So the key question is, will Labour enforce the condition in the package agreed? The package included the conditionality of revenue being raised. If Labour enforce that, and they can, there's very strong leverage. They have economic power. The executive will have to face up to those things. Now, then you'd probably end up with it's all their fault. A blame game will arise. The responsible thing to do is to take account of what are the needs of the population and what are the aspirations of the population, and therefore to look rationally and coldly at what might be possible. And some revenue raising, as I said last time I was on, Stephen, is distinctly possible.
John Tong, let me get your reaction straight after the news. The Stephen Nolan Show! Walter's in Mora. Morning, Walter.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, sir.
All about this general election. It's an United Kingdom election, not three nations, England, Scotland and Wales. It's about time our First Minister was put up front on that, and let's see how he performs under the stress the other ones are. Because to be quite truthful, we have been left behind for long enough, and I think it's about time that
our First Minister, and you referred to he. Our First Minister is Michelle O'Neill.
Yes, Michelle O'Neill. But the Unionists, none of them, no party from here has been on a debate on television. Last night I watched Fiona Bruce on BBC, and there was nobody from Northern Ireland there. Nothing. And any other debates with Julie Acheson, I think, on ITV, next week, it's still going to be the same. Only three nations.
Well, obviously, here in BBC Northern Ireland, there's a whole range of programming, both already happened and scheduled to happen. There will be an election leaders' debate here on BBC Northern Ireland. Gavin Robinson was on The View last night.
Yes, well, is that going to be four nations?
John Tong, has Walter got a point that we see the leaders in Scotland, we see the leaders in Wales and those national UK debates, as well as obviously the big figures. Why not Northern Ireland, John?
It's a fair question. We ask regularly in election surveys as well, should the parties, the UK-wide parties, stand in Northern Ireland? And opinion tends to be split. Obviously, there are some Conservatives standing. There are five Conservatives standing in the election in Northern Ireland, so they could have been represented. Obviously, the Labour Party doesn't stand in Northern Ireland. You can ask the question, well, why does John Swinney from the SNP, who is not an MP, it's unclear why necessarily the SNP got the same airtime last night as the two people who can be Britain's next Prime Minister, no disrespect to Ed Davey. So I think it's legitimate. But in terms of the Northern Ireland debates, yeah, they are coming. I mean, they're coming. There are leaders' debates on the way, which should be very welcome. And as you say, you know, Gavin Robinson got a fair old going over. I thought he held up well, but he got a fair old going over from Mark Carruthers last night. So and, you know, there's been a whole series in The View where every leader has been put through their paces, each of the main parties in Northern Ireland. So it's not as if they've not had airtime, and it's not as if there's not been debate over it. And there's been analysis in the studio from Suzanne Breen and David McCann. So there has been analysis. What we've not had yet is the audience participation in Northern Ireland, where you've got an audience in the room firing questions at Northern Ireland's leaders. But that is on the way from as far as I understand it.
And to come back to what Andrew McCormick and I were talking about, John, the revenue raising in Northern Ireland, the need for money to pay for vital public services. Has any political party in Northern Ireland got any solution beyond wanting that money from the Treasury.
No, I mean, why on earth would you, as a political party in Northern Ireland, say, yeah, we'll introduce tuition fees, or we'll raise university tuition fees, or we'll introduce prescription charges, or we'll...
Is that not responsible politics to explain we'll how you'll pay charges. For something?
It's politics. I wouldn't say it was responsible politics, but it is politics. You're certainly not going to do that at election time. If there was a long period between elections, which there never is in Northern Ireland anyway, then you might get parties doing it. But it'd be madness to do it now, because people think, my goodness, I don't want them.
Andrew reminded us, John, part of the package, part of the deal for the money we've got in Northern Ireland is that we revenue raise.
Exactly. And remember that Chris Eaton-Harris, as the outgoing Secretary of State, said, well, you know, I'll write off budget deficits as long as the executive comes up with a strong package of local revenue raising measures. That package is yet to be brought forward, and I'm sceptical that it ever will be brought forward. And what you've actually got at the moment are some ministers even, you know, threatening or acknowledging they will overspend. So Mike Nesbitt at the Health Ministry says, you know, we can't make ends meet in terms of the health budget. If necessary, we'll overspend. I mean, yeah, in one sense, you don't blame him for saying that, but it's an extraordinary way to go, because ultimately you cannot overspend in perpetuity and expect the British government to always bail you out. I mean, that's the issue.
And Andrew McCormick, on that overspending issue, Paul Given, the education minister yesterday from the DUP, he made it clear he will not overspend. He will not bust the budget.
Well, he's in a different position. He can probably exercise greater control without doing such immediate damage. The damage in the health service that the health department is talking about and the health minister is very severe. We saw a couple of weeks ago the input from the trust chairs explaining what the cuts position would mean. I would put it this way, Stephen, we pay for water. We pay for water by making old people suffer. That's how we pay for water, by denying resources to the health service. That's the balance. That's the choice that our ministers have made. It's the choice, actually, that our electorate goes along with, because they don't, as we said earlier, they don't shout at ministers when they're asked to answer questions, to say, this is a disgrace. We can't put up with these health service waiting lists. We haven't seen that direct confrontation that John was talking about there. That's the choice that people are making, and that's the way it's turning out.
Can you stand over that, though? Because people would argue they're already paying for water.
There is no separate bill. The bill for our regional rate is lower than what people pay in council tax. You take the two together, we're way, way down. Certainly if you add what people pay, people like John pay, and my son and lives in England, they pay, if you add what they pay for council tax and water charges, they're nearly double what the average household is paying in Northern Ireland through the regional rate. Those are the mathematical facts. So anybody who says we pay for water, well, then we don't pay hardly anything for the rest of the services that are paid for through the regional rate. Whatever way you look at it, we're not paying as much. And there's I can accept an argument that we shouldn't pay at the full level of the English average, because there is greater social deprivation in Northern Ireland. So some differential is justifiable. But the big differential, the enormous differential between what is contributed by households here and in England is not, it would be justifiable if the ministers are prepared to defend the services that result from that.
It's a deliberately provocative statement from you this morning, Andrew. You're essentially saying that politicians are taking a decision to allow older people to suffer by not implementing a separate water charge. That's what you're saying.
Yes, well, that's the consequence of the decision that's being taken. There's more that could be done about waiting lists, more that could be done about any... Now, health needs a lot more than money. There's a lot more to the health issue than money. But a bit of progress through raising revenue would make a difference.
Is there any political party, John Tong, in Northern Ireland advocating a water charge?
No, I mean, Alliance has sort of often talked about a water charge, but no party has decisively said we must introduce water charges in Northern Ireland. And again, you know, going back to my point, I can understand why parties would fight shy of that. They argue, look, introducing a couple of local charges, they argue, is not a serious solution for a wider analysis of Northern Ireland's fiscal framework.
You say that, but if we ride on the horse that Andrew McCormick is running this morning, you say that you can understand why the political parties would not introduce it, John, especially at election time. We get that. Until you're one of those people sitting in A&E and you're there. I was there a couple of weeks ago. I hurt my big toe, for goodness sake, right? I watched around me, packed to the gills, packed, and people coming up to me telling me they'd been there 12 hours. They'd been there 16 hours sitting in A&E. And I hear these stories every day. I see them every day coming into the Nolan radio show. The NHS is in crisis, many people would argue, in Northern Ireland. And Andrew McCormick is saying part of that is a political choice for not raising money through water.
Well, the broader choices, I mean, look over the last year. The Conservative government at Westminster cut national insurance by 2p in the pound twice. So we're 4p in the pound better off. Now, don't get me wrong, at the end of every month when I see my salary, it's nice having that extra take-home pay. I love it, yeah. But, you know, I'm thinking, is this appropriate? Are we right to cut national insurance at a time where the NHS, to different degrees, is in crisis across the UK? Is the right approach to simply cut national insurance? Would it have been better to have an extra 4p in the pound paid in national insurance to try and help the National Health Service? Those are the choices. People like take-home pay. They're fearful of higher tax and they don't like national insurance. Every single survey shows that. So you've got to decide what you want. Do you want a high level of tax, high level of national insurance and a fully funded NHS, or do you want more take-home pay?
Andrew,
those are hard choices.
You can speak a bit freer now that you're out of your former job as a senior civil servant. How much real analysis, real debate was there behind the scenes of Stormont to decide whether water charges was the way to go?
So in 2002, there was very serious attention paid to it. And then between 2002 and the restoration of devolution in 2007, the plans were there, the bills were ready to go. And there was a clear view. I had direct conversations with local politicians while they were out of office saying, oh, this will be okay. The UK government will bring in water charges and we'll blame them, but we won't change them. We'll accept, we'll take it as a fait accompli when I get back.
Political parties had those discussions with you?
Yeah, yeah. It was a well-known understanding. It changed in the course
What year was that, Andrew?
So in somewhere between 2002 and 2007, I can't remember precisely, but there was very detailed planning. There was a firm decision to do it. The water service was restructured in law, so there were legal aspects, making it a government-owned company. All that was taken through immense amount of work. David Stirling was the lead official in DRD on this. This was an immense amount of work was done. We were ready to do it. Then there was a political pushback, and Peter Hain took the view that he could help secure devolution by doing a U-turn. He did a big U-turn and said, right, fair enough, we'll allow you to postpone the introduction of water charges if you go back into devolution. And they did. So, you know, that's the way politics worked out. But
and it was only supposed to be postponed, was it?
That was the original thought. There was then a further report, which Conor Murphy, as DRD Minister, commissioned by Paddy Hilliard. So there's further work was done even in 07, 08, 09. So very serious thought given to it. But I totally understand what John is saying. Why would anyone do it if you can get away with it? It's a political expedient. But do you mind if I just come back to what John is saying about national insurance?
Of course.
Because I'm old enough to remember when the Johnson government announced and determined an increase in national insurance, which would have come a health and social care levy, in order to solve the problem of social care. Social care is right at the heart of the problems that affect the health service. And the Johnson government had made a decision to proceed which involved increasing revenue. And that would have applied to Northern Ireland and would have made it possible in Northern Ireland, as well as the rest of the UK, to have a reformed approach to the financing of social care. That was a major game changer. The Conservatives backtracked on that for their own reasons and are now championing tax cuts. But that's the kind of thing that can happen. That was a very clear and very, very positive development to solve an immense problem, which is social care.
Andrew, finally, let me come back to what we were talking about in terms of the potential revenue from water. With the analysis that you saw when you were in that job, if water charges were implemented in Northern Ireland, what impact would it have on the money available for public services?
It would. If water was self-financing, then you take several hundred million pounds of revenue and of capital expenditure, which are no longer needing to be funded from public expenditure. That's the position. And of course, the way Barnett works, we get nothing from water because water is privatised across the water.
So how significant would that be, that couple of hundred million pounds?
It's significant in itself because it would allow some easement. It doesn't solve the problems by the totality of budgetary problems. By no means, it's not enough to do that. It would be a game changer in a tactical relationship with the Treasury. Time and again, and I had this personal experience many times, you don't get a hearing from the Treasury when they can say, you're not prepared to contribute yourselves. That's an incredibly strong argument. I faced it in 02. I understand it still was part of the discussions around last Christmas time before the restoration of devolution. This is still a Treasury perception. Northern Ireland is just asking for more and never prepared to contribute.
And
so if that tactical change happened, then the opportunity of persuading Treasury to look at other things, not necessarily generously, Treasury are never going to be generous, but maybe a bit more reasonably.
And finally, Andrew, you've worked with all of those political parties for many years. Some of those senior people that have been around those political parties for a long time, they might be very angry with you and indeed frustrated because there's a significant vote base within the elderly community. They might be angry with you about your statement this morning that they are choosing to allow elderly people to suffer rather than implement water charges.
I would just point out that I've managed to maintain political neutrality because there's nobody not making that decision.
But you stand over it.
It's a mathematical fact. If we raise water charges, we could do more about waiting lists. It wouldn't solve it completely by any means, but it would be a massive step in the right direction.
Final thoughts from you, John?
I agree with Andrew. I think it would help relations with the UK Treasury to introduce water charges, provided that low-income households are exempt. I mean, I pay about £25 a month. It's not a horrendous bill for water charges. I can afford to pay it. So for those who can afford to pay it in Northern Ireland, I think it's a logical thing to do. It's a tactical thing to do, as Andrew indicates. But, you know, let's face it, it's going to be unwelcome. But ultimately, I don't think it's a credible position for the political parties to simply say, we're not engaging in any local revenue raising whatsoever. Even an initially sympathetic Labour government would soon tire of that approach.
John Tong, thank you. Andrew McCormick, good to talk to you as always, sir. Thank you very much indeed. 03030 80 55 55. We're going to break away to a story about a video, on social media that's appearing to show drug use on the streets of Belfast in broad daylight on Thursday afternoon. It occurred at the top of Castle Lane, in other words, right in the heart of Belfast city centre. Taylor, entrepreneur, Chris Souter with us this morning. Good morning to you, Chris.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. The police are responding to this now as well, wanting to offer their reassurances that legal drug use and supply is something they take seriously. But this is appearing to happen in the centre of Belfast.
Stephen, honestly, I'm getting sent videos of the city and the demise on a daily basis. And I'm very careful at what I share. This, and to be fair, I haven't been sharing everything I've got, but this landed in my inbox this morning, and it literally shocked me, Stephen. There, if you go onto the Twitter and go onto my app, Tudor Brothers, and have a look at it, there are guys doing lines of cocaine in the middle of Donegal Place. Now, I think this was at 6 o'clock last night, and it's just, it's like, see, I'm watching the video as you're watching it, and like, I understand that there's like these guys might have issues, but for this to be taking place in broad daylight with families around, with people coming into the city to shop and do the late night shopping, this is just, Stephen, this is just, it's horrendous. Where is the policing side of things? Where is the safety in our city?
South Belfast Policing Commander, Chief Inspector Mark Conway, has told us, we carry out regular patrols in the city centre and will continue to do so as part of our commitment to addressing this issue. Well, there were members of the public videoing this. It's all over Twitter now. It's all over social media. Where was the regular patrol that's doing the city centre that didn't see this?
Is Mark on the phone with us? No.
No. Statement.
No, well, if you look at the first part of the video, the police actually drive past while this is taking place. Like, you couldn't write this, you couldn't make this up. So, Stephen, this for me, like, this isn't just about this one single specific incident. This is just about the greater safety of the city and a conversation, not even a conversation that we now need to have, because the conversation has started. We now need action. We need something from the police. I understand policing is ridiculously hard in this country, Stephen. Please don't think that I don't understand how hard our police service get it. But we need something done, because this type of thing may happen more regularly. And I'm already getting messages left, right and centre that it does happen regularly in certain parts
of
the city.
But for people that haven't seen this video, this is a guy sitting on the footpath openly with what appears to be drug paraphernalia on the ground, snorting on the ground with a crowd around him. So this isn't up some back entry. Not that that would be any more acceptable, but this is in broad daylight on the ground. So what, are our pavements now the countertops for drugs? Does this happen elsewhere?
I just don't. It doesn't happen. Well, maybe it does happen elsewhere, but not that I know of anyway, Stephen. There's no other major UK or European city that I have seen this type of drug use taking place in broad daylight on one of the busiest shopping days with nothing happening about it. Now, I haven't spoken to the police yet, Stephen, so I'm not sure whether were these guys arrested after this video was put out. It's certainly not what I've heard back. We just need to put like a statement, rather than maybe concentrate on this one specific video, this needs to just be, it's like what I've been saying the last couple of months on your show, we need something done. We need civic leadership to take charge of this city, Stephen. To me, as a business owner and a ratepayer and an employer and a taxpayer, it feels to me, Stephen, like no one's in charge. Like there's nobody in charge in this city. Like it's just anarchy. That's what it feels like to me.
And that's not anarchy, is it?
But that's a term that I'm using. That's what it feels like to me, Stephen. It feels like no one's in charge. And what is the a definition of anarchy? I would probably say it's no one in charge. So look, I need something. We as a city need something done about this, Stephen, because I'm sick and tired of a city that I love, and I love this city. You know the passion I have for this city, Stephen. I am sick and tired of this every single day. Something coming into my inbox about something else that needs done, and it seems that nothing is being done about it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't conversations going on behind the scenes and things are in place, but we need to know about it, and we need something done. So
how much drug taking? Remember, we're talking about human beings with addictions here.
Yes.
How much drug taking, open drug taking, is there around our capital city and Royal Avenue and that epicentre of shopping?
Yes, Stephen, there's a lot. And here, let's not lose sight of the fact that there are vulnerable people and people that need help here. Number one, why are they not getting their help? And number two, why is it in the middle of the flipping street for everybody else to see? This is such a wider conversation, but it needs action, Stephen. This is my point. There doesn't seem to be anything being done about it. So fingers crossed with this little bit of this little bit of a chat here, Stephen. Somebody takes note of it and somebody starts doing something about it, particularly the PSNI and Belfast City Council.
Well, the PSNI say their officers engage with partner agencies, local reps on an ongoing basis. As they say, we seek collaborative and proactive solutions to issues around the abuse of drugs.
Yeah, and like that, what does that, what does that even mean? Like that, does that mean that they're out on the streets? Like if there was a greater presence of security in the city, would these guys, would these be, would these guys be out snorting cocaine?
Do we fund the police? Do we fund the police enough to have a greater presence of street officers? Like to be fair to them, what budget have they been given?
That's the crack, Stephen. That's something that we need to discuss. And if there's not enough money for police, then we need to get more money for police. This is where our political leadership comes into it. Don't start me on them this morning. But this is where there needs to be a greater spotlight put on the safety of our major city. Belfast, the main economic driver for the entire country. We need this sorted out, and we need it sorted out ASAP, Stephen. Because, look, I'm in business here. I'm only 42 years old. I plan to be in Belfast in business for the next 25 years. I don't want my city going down the tubes like this. This is me just talking personally. And I believe that I would be talking for many retailers and many people in the city. I need something done about this ASAP. I need somebody to take charge, Stephen.
Okay.
I need somebody to stand up and be counted. Chris, somebody take charge of this.
Chris Souter, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Linda McCauley's last show this week. She's sitting here in front of me. Big interview with Linda McCauley coming up straight after the 10 o'clock news. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Sorry, Linda and I just chatting.
Distracting you, am I?
Yeah, as usual.
As usual.
Listen, a sad day, really, as we talk about your departure from BBC Northern Ireland.
BBC Radio Ulster, yes, indeed. Well, sad and celebratory looking back and all the wonderful things that have happened on your behalf, all the fun I've had, all the great people I've worked with, excluding yourself, of course. it's a celebration as well. I know that's a bit of a sort of a silly thing to say, but I'm feeling quite good about everything.
Why are you going?
I just feel it's time, Stephen. There comes a moment when people keep saying, you'll know when the time is right, you'll know when you know, and suddenly I did know. And I know you're going to push me on this, but I do have a significant birthday coming up.
I'm not going to push you, but look, this programme doesn't pull its punches. So was it your choice?
Oh, my choice.
Were you pushed?
No pushing.
Was anything like that going on?
No, it was my choice. I thought about it over Christmas. I talked to that many friends about it. I thought I'd better say to the bosses. So I came in after Christmas and said to Emma Dunseith, the head of Radio Ulster, I'm not going to renew my annual contract and I'll work on as long as you want me to, but I'm stopping. So, no, my choice, my time. And anyway, Stephen, there comes a point where you have to let younger people do things. You can't let old fogies sit and block, like bed blocking in hotels, in hospitals, like bed blocking. Nobody moves on. So you've got to let
really?
People
So did you feel a responsibility to create an opportunity for a younger person? Really?
Well, it's good that somebody new and younger comes along. It's always good when new talent comes along. And I've done it for 29 years. That's quite a long time.
Are you tired?
No, I still get a buzz. I get a great buzz from live broadcasting. So you know what it's like, no matter how you feel, when you get the buzz of live on air with a live
totally,
microphone.
Absolutely.
It's a buzz. And you perform.
So what was going on in your personal head then and your personal life? Because it's a big thing for anybody when you decide to give up what you've done throughout your whole life.
Well, not my whole life.
Well, for the majority of your working career, and we'll go back to other things that you did as well, other radio stations you worked in. But it is such a massive decision for all of us, no matter what job we're in.
It's quite frightening.
When do we let go?
Exactly. Big change. It is.
So what was going on in your head?
I think the time is right. And suddenly the time did feel right. Out of the blue, I felt I knew it was the right time to go. And also, Radio Ulster is changing. It's having to change. How people listen is changing. I have had the golden years of radio. I've had radio from 1976, from downtown radio. And there was none of this fancy palaver of people looking on their phones to listen back or listen to sounds or any of that nonsense. You know, you turn the radio on to hear the dog racing or the greyhound or the horse racing results, which I started reading in downtown. Or you turn the radio on to find out the weather. There was one time in Downtown Radio. I was reading the news and I went down. Again, it was all on paper and manual typewriters. And I went down, I was reading the news and I got to the last page. I said, and now for the weather. And somebody hadn't written the weather up at all. And there it was, blank. And I just said off the cuff, be a mixture of sunshine and showers and cooler near the coast. You know, I would do Northern Ireland most days. But in those days, people, actually, it was the middle of the Troubles. People turned the radio on, Radio Ulster on, to find out what had happened the night before. And it meant that, particularly in homes right around, but particularly in rural areas, the radio in the kitchen, the wireless in the kitchen, was permanently on Radio Ulster. And indeed, in 70s Downtown Radio, because we were making the calls every half hour to the police and the army and the fire brigade, what's happened. And there was a lot happening. And that was the only way people found out, was what was on the radio. And that connection that you make with people, it never leaves you. You realise that it matters to your listeners, and radio matters to listeners. I mean, you know, you think television's all fancy and dancy and all the rest of it, but it's only radio that really matters.
How did you start?
I started in Downtown Radio.
How did you get your break in there?
I was, one day they needed somebody to read the Greyhound and the horse racing results, and the journalist didn't want to, thought it wasn't journalistic.
And were you working behind the scenes in there?
Yeah, I was just taking copy in the newsroom, and I read those results for a little while. I got some good advice from a veteran broadcaster, Bram McSherry from RTE, because I said, some of these horses and greyhounds have got very odd names. I'm a bit worried. He says, Linda, say it once, say it clearly, don't correct yourself, and people will think that's how you say the word. So, and then I got a call from BBC. I got a call from Radio Ulster. I got a call from Malcolm McAllister and Dan Gilbert asking me to come up. And that's when I started presenting a programme here. 1978. What were you doing in 78? Were you in your high chair?
I was five.
There you are then.
I was five. So you came to Radio Ulster in 1970.
I did for a year. I was here for a year and then I went back to downtown.
Why?
Well, I got sacked actually. Now that you mention it.
You got sacked?
Yeah, well, they didn't renew the programme. They didn't, so that was that. So I went back to downtown. Your radio's like that.
What programme were you doing?
It was called Change Gear. It was a drive time programme. And the contract wasn't renewed. How we say
Why
that.
Not?
You need to ask the then controller. I've asked him that and he keeps saying, look, stop, Linda, don't go on. He says, I gave you new opportunities. I put you in the right direction. But sure, that's all history. And then I went back to downtown for a while. I had three children.
It's extraordinary, those twists, isn't it?
Isn't it the twists?
In any career.
It is. Well, the twist here is that I went back to downtown. I had three children. I worked throughout with three children, three under four, and kept working. And then I stopped after I had my third son, and I was getting involved with local. You know, I'm bossy, Stephen. You know, I like to organise things. I know you're nodding. So
scary spice.
Exactly. So I started organising things in the mother and toddler group and in the local church. Started organising. And there was no playground for the children. So we saw in the paper one day that Challenge Annika was wanting to, a brand new programme. I wanted to get challenges across the UK. So we thought, we'll challenge her. We'll say, oh, Ballinahinch is a badly divided Protestant Catholic community and cross-community playground needed. And, oh, we played up, pulled all the strings, you know. And we rang London, and a girl from Northern Ireland answered the phone. Janine Waddell of Waddell. To be Waddell Productions.
I know Janine.
You know Janine. So I said, oh, it was lovely. We've got Ulster accent.
What a formidable woman.
Absolutely. So she brought...
talented
she organised, and absolutely. Mentorn it was, Mentorn Films. She brought Challenge Annika to Ballinahinch. So the excitement, as you can imagine. So at that point, the Morning Extra programme was presented by Wendy Austin, who also started in downtown. You know, a huge list of people started in downtown. Pamela Ballantyne, Maggie Taggart, Barbara, Paddy O'Flaherty, Mervyn Jess, you know, just everybody started in downtown radio in those days. It was just a starting point. But anyway, Wendy was presenting this programme. She was going off for a month to do some work with Oxfam, and I was asked, would I come and fill for 2 weeks? And I stayed, and that was it. You see, it's just happenstance. It's just coincidence.
What was the transition like from commercial radio to the BBC? For me, it was massive, because I was used to, when I was in BCR, then Citybeat, when I was used to, in commercial radio, you know, I literally at night time, when a track was playing, went and answered the door. I was answering the phones as well as presenting while the music was playing. And you come into the BBC and you're surrounded with resource. How was it for you?
It's very different, isn't it? And it's probably more obvious to you, because by that time, you know, commercial radio was bigger. Downtown was, you know, the trailblazer at that stage. But BBC's different. It manages it differently. But it's a wonderful organisation in so many ways. You know, it gives people so many opportunities. And I was in Enniskillen Castle yesterday for a special event marking the 100 years of BBC in Northern Ireland. Don't say it. I wasn't there for a whole 100. You know, not a lot of it, but not all of it. But, you know, the feeling of how much we matter when you get out round those towns, because radio matters.
Well, listen, apparently I'm getting the blame for your departure from the BBC. Let's have a listen.
Hello, Linda, on your behalf, Macaulay MBE here, North Down made flesh. Yes, I'm the woman whose voice is so posh, I used to give elocution lessons to the Queen. I'm finally leaving the BBC after 29 years. Why? Well, because they have no money left after they pay Stephen Nolan. But fear not, I'm still going to be working on your behalf. What am I going to be doing on your behalf? Well, sea swimming and golf mainly, but I'm also going to be teaching the people of Northern Ireland how to speak properly on your behalf. Yes, I can make even the roughest accent sound acceptable at a dinner party in Donaghadee. Listen to this, satisfied customer.
Hello, Anastasia Huntington Carter from Hollywood here. I thought I spoke properly until I met Linda Macaulay, and it turned out I actually spoke like Mae McFetridge on a night out in the Dockers Club. But after taking the Linda Macaulay How to Speak North Down course, I could pass for a long-lost member of the royal family. I now sound like a yoga teacher from Helen's Bay who'd fit in perfectly at Gymkhana or the Up Club in Kiltraw.
So if you want to speak like Anastasia, look out for my How to Speak North Down course. But for now, it's finally farewell from me to Radio Ulster, and on your behalf, felicitations to you all. Right, that's finally over. Somebody get me a fig and a double whiskey.
Perfect. Ulster, of course.
Well, I just speak the way I speak, and I think that you need to speak clearly and properly on the radio.
Do you think you're posh?
I'd rather have been Posh Spice than Scary Spice when you named me, by the way. No, what is posh out anyway?
Who are you really?
I am exactly what you see and what you get on Radio Ulster. I have been myself on air, always talked about myself, always talked about personal issues. I've always given of myself. I know I don't keep a secret bit to the side. I mean, I've talked about the fact that I was a single parent for 6 years, bringing up three boys.
How old were you when that happened?
How old was I, or how old were they?
No, how old were you? And how old?
Well, they were 7, 9, and 11, and I was on my own for 6 years. So, you know,
so that's a lot while holding down a career.
Yeah, and that was a daily program I was doing there. You know, and I actually told the then controller, I said, you know, I'm coming in every morning doing a program, and I'm not living at home. I'm living with a friend with my children. I'm coming in every morning, and you know, do you not know what I mean? That when your microphone comes on, that you kind of perform, gather yourself, you know that, don't you?
It's a very important part of my life.
Yeah.
Very important. But you had three kids at home.
Yes, and also on an annual contract, wondering would that be renewed every year? You know, that's tough. So I do understand a lot of the things that people are going through that you maybe think I didn't, but, you know, I had all that experience myself.
And was that a game-changing moment for you, being a single parent? Did it change your outlook on things and what priorities were? And
well, your priorities are always your children.
But how stressful was it being a single parent?
It's a very stressful thing because there's nobody else there to help. There's nobody else to pay any bill with you. You know, you're on your own. A lot of women are in this situation. I have great understanding of what it's like for them. It was a difficult time.
And look, I don't want to get into anything personal. Was it your choice you were a single parent?
It was.
Okay.
And it's always better when it's your choice, isn't it? You know, you always feel a bit of strength when you made the decision.
Do your children talk to you much about your job?
Well, it's funny you say that. I'm not even sure that they listen that often. There was one occasion, and I had remarried, and I've been remarried for 25 years to Paul. There was one occasion I was on air, and I think he was actually watching sport on television at the same time, pretending he had the radio on. So the radio turned up quite loud. So my voice was probably echoing around the house, and one of my boys said, "What, Mum? What do you want, Mum? What is it, Mum?" And Paul said, "Would you ever be quiet? Your mother's on the radio."
Brilliant.
Yeah.
They must be proud of you then.
They probably are. They probably are. Boys aren't very good at saying it aloud, but I know they are. They have told me, yes, they're proud. They were proud when, for example, when I was given an MBE for services to consumers. They were proud of that. I mean,
you must have been proud too.
Oh, chuffed pink, absolutely. You know, services to consumers, yeah, that sort of sums it up. It was a great accolade, it was.
How hard do you have to fight? I know the answer to this, but how hard do you have to fight some of these companies to get answers?
Well, you do know the answer. You do know that the BBC email and logo helps, of course. You know, once they see, oh gosh, it's the BBC asking the question. I always think it's somebody one layer up who suddenly deals with the issue and they think, oh, this is dreadful. I mean, a few weeks ago, Stephen, the poor woman whose husband died on the morning they were about to go to Disney to make their engagement official. And Disney said that she hadn't given 72 hours notice. I mean, really, you know, that kind of thing. You think when somebody's higher up the chain looks at them, they have some common sense. And we do get through all that red tape. You know yourself.
Pamela Ballantyne.
Good friend. Met her in downtown friend. In the 70s.
She sent a wee message to you.
Linda McCauley, it's Pamela Ballantyne here. I cannot believe that you are finally hanging up the headphones and the microphone. The airwaves will not be the same without you. We have worked together many, many, many years, going back to our days in downtown radio when you were doing the traffic and doing the news and doing everything pretty much. And also presenting It Takes Two with Bill Naylor, I think it was, and also Hendy. So you will be missed. The fact that you have been the consumer's champion for, more years than we care to remember is just incredible. Whoever takes over has got big shoes to fill. May I wish you a very happy, it's hard to use the word retirement because I know you're going to be as busy as ever. And just think, it gives us more opportunities to go out for lunch. Wishing you a very, very happy future.
That's lovely. Pamela and I have been friends since the 70s. A woman at the event at Enniskillen Castle yesterday said it's not retirement, it's refirement. Well, it's only words. I got so many cards say welcome to retirement. It's not a very nice word, is it?
So you're not retiring?
No, I am not going to. I'm going to retire from On Your Behalf. I'm going to do other things.
Like what?
Well, I've had some approaches.
You're going to move to other radio stations?
I've had some approaches.
From other radio stations?
I couldn't possibly comment.
Why not?
Because you would tell everybody all over the airwaves and I wait till... Jim Allister wouldn't tell you, would he, when he was about to announce his candidates? I'll tell you when the time's right.
So that's interesting.
I thought you'd like that.
So you've been offered other opportunities?
Have been put in my way and I am in discussions.
Did you seek them?
No. No, no, no. Somebody said to me, you won't know what's out there, what the safety net is until you jump. So when you say you're moving, then things happen. Do you think you'll retire, Stephen?
Stop putting it on to me.
Why not?
Because this is about you today. And would you be contemplating doing another consumer programme elsewhere?
Well, I'll have to have some discussions and I'll certainly come back and tell you. I mean, I know you're going to miss me on a Friday. Are you going to miss me on a Friday morning?
I am going to miss you. I'll have to admit that.
And when are you going to take me to our golf club, the one that I proposed you to and you joined and you keep threatening to take me out and buy me my ticket?
I will take you out to the golf club within the next few weeks because you've also invited Mr. Buckler, haven't you?
Absolutely.
To the golf club.
He's a local boy, Helen's Bay boy, born and bred.
Yes, so he and I will very much look forward to dinner with you. Oh, here's Gloria. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Actually, I can give you the news. You see, I have taken Linda on board and Rip Off Britain. So there you are. You can tell the world.
Gloria, it was a secret. You shouldn't have told Stephen.
Oh,
you know
well,
he
Linda,
can't.
You know, a good girl like you can't go amiss. By the way, that's all fictitious, listener, just in case. I couldn't resist it.
I was going to say, I can't believe you could afford her fee.
you should say to Stephen, that's all for me to know and for you to find out.
That's what he's trying to find out. You know what he's like. It's lovely to talk to you, Gloria. I was asked yesterday at the event in Enniskillen Castle. BBC's going round Northern Ireland marking 100 years. I was asked who I admired, and I said you, because you were an absolute icon to us all.
Just forgotten about me, Gloria.
Well, yeah, just to talk to Stephen for a moment.
Linda. And I wouldn't be on this programme if I didn't admire you and have admired you and known you for years. Were you at Crum Castle yesterday?
No, at Enniskillen Castle we were. Right in the middle there.
I must tell you a funny story, though, about Crum, which I know and love very much. When we were all working at the BBC and a man called Alan Giff was doing the farming at BBC Northern Ireland, or Radio Ulster, he came in one day and he said, I discovered, by the way, that down in the farmyard at Crum Castle, they're renting out the cottages. And we all rented out a cottage at the time. And do you know what our rent was for a beautiful double-fronted stone house? It was £138 a year, peppercorn rent.
Brilliant. So how far back do you two go?
Quite far, Linda. I think I was there before you, Linda.
You were doing A Touch of Honey, weren't you?
I was, indeed. Yes. And that was quite interesting at that period of time with Radio Ulster, because there was really not very much what I would call free-flow broadcasting. It was all pretty well designed and scripted and a bit like the Today programme, as we did the Today version in Northern Ireland of the big programme. But it was all kind of planned out and round table stuff.
It was. But then you made the major jump that impressed me so much. You managed to move to national radio. You took over Jimmy Young's show, didn't you, in Radio 2?
I did, but Linda was given it. You know, I wasn't looking for it. I was very happy in Northern Ireland and doing whatever I was doing at the time and no ambition whatsoever to go to London. But then a gentleman came along and just offered me the job of Jimmy Young, and then for 2 weeks. And on the very last day, he invited me up for a cup of tea, and I thought, this is great. I'd like to come to London occasionally. And he then offered me a permanent job. So, I mean, it just shows you how lucky I was.
It's the same kind of opportunity as I had, because I filled in for Wendy Austin and she went on to other things and I stayed on. It's opportunity. Opportunity knocks. You're talking about Crum Castle, which I also loved. I made a series of programmes looking around stately homes, and I went to interview Lord Erne there, the former Lord Erne. And I said, sir, how shall I refer to you? And he said to me, there's Upper Erne and Lower Erne, I'm Harry Erne. Just call me Harry.
I know. He was funny enough. I was asked to speak at his funeral, which I was very, very blessed to do, because he was a wonderful man.
He was.
And I know the new Lord Erne, John, of course, he was only seven when we were occupying the castle down at the farmyard, or the piggery, I think it was called then.
It was lovely.
So lots of lovely memories.
I think Stephen wants to speak, Gloria.
I'm just trying to get a word in with you.
His mouth is opening and closing here, and nothing's coming out. Yes, Stephen.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Seriously, as long as you're trailless, isn't it? So, Gloria, you will understand in this industry how the really good broadcasters, a mark is their longevity. Because it's very easy to do a small number of shows or to do one series. It's the mark of an accomplished broadcaster that lasts decades. People like yourself and people like Linda. So what do you think, Gloria, it is about Linda that means that... How long are you on air now?
Downtown from 1976. You know, 48 years, really.
So what do you think that is about her, Gloria?
Well, there are a lot of things there. I mean, first of all, you have to be given a bit of luck. And then I always say to young people who say, how do you get on the telly? I just said, if you get your stroke of luck, you then have to work very hard to keep it. And so therefore, you have to be dedicated or really love what you're doing. And I know that Linda loved what she was doing. The other aspect is you have to be prepared to go. It's a bit like a tree. You know, you might be, in terms of television, it might be prime time in that central trunk for a while. But then you have to be prepared to branch off. Like, for example, when Channel 5 was regarded as a bit of a smarmy station at night time and, you know, not very nice films and everything. When I was offered a job at Channel 5, which I did for 5 years daily, a lot of people said to me, are you sure you want to work for that? And I went, yes, I do, because they've given me a clean sheet and I wanted to try something new. So you have to kind of spin it a bit and make it work for you, and you have to really love it. I have loved every second of broadcasting.
Gloria, excuse me a moment, Stephen. Gloria, Stephen was pushing me about having a posh voice. Did you have to change your voice to go to national radio?
I had to change words because I was doing a World Service programme in Belfast, and when I went to London the very first week, I did it from London, from Bush House, and I was quite daunted by the size of Bush House, etc. And this very, very posh English producer, when I finished the programme, was all about Irish music, and he said to me, he said, lovely, he said, do you always speak as quickly as that? And I said, do I speak quickly? Mm-hmm. He said, the problem is, he said, Gloria, he said, by the time this goes to the bush in short wave, they might not be able to hear it all. And so there were certain words, speed of delivery, different pronunciations, things like that. But I think I speak the way I always spoke, but just minor changes.
Gloria, thank you for coming on this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gloria. I'm so pleased. I said you were my icon yesterday and here you are on this morning. Thank you so much.
The BBC clearly is close to your heart. And you mentioned that earlier. You must have very fond memories of this place, and I think there's I think when you work in here for a certain amount of time, you feel how lucky you are to be part of this amazing organisation. Do you?
I do, and I've actually sent a series of emails out to different sectors within the BBC. I sent one to our security staff, our front of house. I sent one up to the canteen. I sent one up to the cleaners. I sent one to our engineers and our IT. I sent one to our production people saying, thank you for helping me, because, I mean, we couldn't do it on our own. I mean, you wouldn't know which button to press, Stephen, on your own, really, would you?
No.
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 These guys behind the glass are making you look good.
But I think BBC Northern Ireland, I mean this, and I wonder, you know, now that you're going, I want to give you an opportunity, what your thoughts are. I think there is an incredible connection between BBC Northern Ireland, BBC Radio Ulster, and the people out there. Like, I really do. It's phenomenal.
Absolutely. I said from the beginning that in Northern Ireland, in the bad old days, people turned on the radio and radio became and is their friend and still is. I do feel possibly that I've had the glory years. I've had the really good years when radio mattered. Now it's so diverse the way people can listen. There's so many things to listen to. But still, Radio Ulster and On Your Behalf and my feelings about listeners. You don't go anywhere. You sit here
you
in a chair.
Go out.
I go right. I've been right across Northern Ireland with my tape recorder talking to all sorts of people. I met
God
some
help
of them,
them.
Came yesterday to the Enniskillen. Pat the Butcher, who used to open the unattended studio in Enniskillen, he was there, for example. We used to have our studios right round. I've been everywhere around, talked to people, and I feel that's the heart of radio. Listeners,
you're going to have more free time, right? Like, there's no doubt about that. So, are there, like, do you want to travel? What do you want to do? I harbour the day when I can travel a lot more. Is that what you're going to do with more free time?
Well, I will travel, but I have other interests as well. I do have other thoughts. I'm going on a big trip. I'm going to America and then on to Australia for a month. I'm going to a family wedding in America and then I'm going on to Australia to see my son for a month. And we talk about that on the programme tomorrow. It's the very last programme and we're talking about travelling on our own and all this kind of thing and talking to people. And I've also got a wonderful piece that you'll love tomorrow from Dan Gordon, who's written a monologue likening On Your Behalf to a department store. And who, of course, has he dubbed me? I'm Mrs. Slocum.
Are you frightened?
Apprehensive. It's going to feel very funny walking out of the building today. This is the last time I'll walk out. This is the very last time I'll walk
That's
out of the
building. That's an emotional
As an employee.
You.
Yes, and I haven't cried yet. I brought tissues up my sleeve in case you would make me cry.
But it will be an emotional moment.
It
right?
will. It is. Very much
yeah,
so.
That pass will stop working.
They'll cut me off. No emails.
You won't be able to come back in.
And, you know,
are you ready for that?
This is what you wanted.
Are you ready for that?
I've got to make myself ready. I'm going to, as Mrs. Slocum did, I'm going to hoist up my bosoms and my corsage and I'm going to get myself ready.
We have 1 minute left. I want to give you that minute to speak to the public that have listened to you for so many years and I want to let you say goodbye to them.
Oh, Stephen, have you liked me coming in on a Friday?
Yeah, big time. You're a lovely person. You're a real lovely, authentic person. I like authenticity and that's you.
Well, that's nice. Well, look, I have had a most wonderful career, most wonderful time. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I've enjoyed meeting the listeners. I've enjoyed working with so many people here at BBC Radio Ulster. I think radio is the heart of everything. And the problems we've solved for people, Jimmy Hughes on your behalf, how could we do it without Jimmy Hughes? How could we do it without Ali Neveson? It's been a ball. Thank you, Stephen.
Connor wants to speak to you. Linda, good morning, Connor.
Linda, good morning. Good morning.
Morning, Connor.
I'm going to miss you. So, Stephen, there's a studio in front of me here, right? It's right in my eye line. And every Thursday and Friday, Linda comes in here and she's in my eye line, right?
That's my studio.
Well, basically, we have the studio booked, right? And about a year ago, Linda came in and says, do you mind if I use that for a few minutes? I went, Linda, that's yours. I can never, ever say that you can or can't do anything because the smile and the joy and the happiness that you bring into every space that you hold is amazing. Stephen, I think that's one thing you see. You've known Linda longer than I. It's that kind of air of happiness she brings into the place.
Absolutely. But I said it a few moments ago. It's actually extraordinary because it's not Linda getting emotional, it's me. But I really do value, as I get older, authentic people who are themselves. And that is Linda McCauley. And I will miss you big time.
Oh, Stephen, would you like me to come in every Friday
good.
Anyway?
You're very, no. I'm making sure security cancel your pass immediately.
Listen, on behalf of me and Mrs. Phillips as well, we'll miss you. You're an absolute joy. And listen, we really look forward to hearing or seeing what you do next because we know there will be something.
Schatz, wir müssen los zu meiner Mutter.
Oh, ich kann leider nicht mit. Der Mähroboter mäht immer noch nicht, wo er soll.
Immer findest du eine Ausrede.
Ja, nein, das ist nicht so leicht.
Sonst läuft bei dir doch auch alles automatisch.
Weniger Ausreden, mehr Automatisierung. Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Stimme deinen Husqvarna-Mähroboter durch individuelle Installation exakt auf deine Anforderungen ab. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.